This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, March 25th, 2009.
Okay, we'll begin. We have the president, Dr. Skorton, with us, and Kent Fox with us,
very
the
good.
Provost.
I'm impressed. There are other ways you can pronounce that.
I remember when I took your photo for your ID when you first came.
Did you get it wrong?
No.
The photo part.
I asked him how to pronounce his name.
Good. At least you asked. I don't show that picture to anybody.
I thought it was a pretty good picture. And do you want to open with any comments?
Just a couple things. Because I think Ken may want to add something as well. I'm glad to get together with you again. Sorry that it took so long. I have worked my way around more than once through the employee assembly, the SA, the GPSA, the UFC, and I always forget the acronym bill for the other faculty committee that I worked with, FPC. I'm sorry that it took so long to get here, not for lack of interest in shared governance, but working a lot through the other elected bodies. As you know, it's a truly extraordinary time throughout the country in higher education. And all you have to do is just look at what's happening with the schools that have the most wealth and to see the things that they're doing. Freezing faculty hiring, stopping construction, laying people off in the hundreds, to know that it's a period that none of us in higher education have ever experienced before. I think you know, I hope you know, what has been going on here. We've made an attempt to be as forthcoming as we can through direct meetings with shared governance groups, through open forums, through every 4 to 6 week general campus emails so that everybody's seeing the same numbers at the same time. But I'm sure you have a lot of questions. One thing I did want to mention is that the last about 2 weeks, the Board of Trustees have now ratified all the actions that we thought were prudent to take in terms of developing a way to balance the university budget over years, not immediately, a way to have enough flexibility, financial flexibility in the hands of the provost to continue faculty hiring. We're one of the few schools in this category that is still hiring faculty and have other means of flexibility and still hiring staff. And then finally, to have some flexibility, financial flexibility for further unforeseen issues. I do want to just review a couple of facts real quick, Rodney, if it's okay, and then I promise I'll stop and yield the floor to Kent and then everybody else. The university, our university falls somewhere between state schools that have very large student bodies, twice or 2.5 times the size of ours, and very small endowments. Those schools have almost no dependence on endowment income. That's not us. That's at one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum are schools that have much smaller student bodies in the Ivy League and enormous endowments. And those schools have up to 45% of their operating funds and endowment earnings. Cornell, at the days of this top strength of the endowment, only 11% of our operating funds were related to endowment earnings. So on our campus, over 75% of the revenues that we use for operations come from sources that have not been affected directly or indirectly by the national economy, have not been affected. So you might ask, so what's the big deal? What's going on here? So part of the problem that we're having has to do with the fact that the market is down, and that accounts for 11% of our revenue. Part of it has to do with the fact that philanthropy is down, and that accounts in general for about 6-7% of our operating funds. The biggest single piece is that over the last at least 10 years, and probably more, but at least 10 years that I've looked at, we've made a lot of decisions on faculty hiring, on construction, on new initiatives, based on the assumption that all the revenue streams in the university would continue to grow, and that assumption is no longer accurate. So the reason that the provost has chosen, with my full support, to cut budgets and to begin to return the university to a setting in which we're living within our means is largely because of very good academic decisions that were made, very good hiring of faculty and staff, very good decisions about prior construction projects that were nonetheless decisions that were made assuming that we would continue to have very brisk increases in tuition, extremely increases, brisk increases in philanthropy, and huge endowment earnings. And a lot of schools around the country, virtually all the schools of our type, made that same kind of a bet. And so you're going to be with me, whether you're on the UA or not, you're going to be with me as members of the community for several years, bringing those curves back together, the curves of revenue and expenditures. I'm going to do the very best I can to be as transparent as possible. I hope that you will agree with me that you're seeing much more data now than we've seen on this campus in a long time. The dean of faculty comes to the vast majority of the meetings of the cabinet, the senior staff group, what would you say, though, 80-plus percent of the meetings. And I will continue, by the lights of the elected representatives, the faculty, staff, and students, to have open forums and ways of communicating. I don't say this next thing to be provocative, but I want you to understand the difference between transparency on the one hand and decisiveness on making certain decisions on the other hand. I'm going to be very consultative. I'm going to listen to as many people's voices as I can. At the end of the day, I have to make decisions about certain things. And some of those decisions you're going to think are very well-founded, and some you're not. And I'm going to do my best to be open to your criticisms and so on. But I want to be clear from the beginning that transparency and final decision-making are two different things. And I want to work with you and with the elected leaders of the SAGPSA, EA, and UFC and FPC to find the best sweet spot that we can between transparency and very deep and broad, both deep and broad consultation on the one hand, and the need to make decisions in a relatively short time course to return the university to a situation where we are on the way to a balanced budget. We've been going in the opposite direction. So that's the long and short of it, and I'm really glad to take any questions. And I don't know if you want to add anything before we start.
Yeah, let me say a little bit. The president has asked me to lead a planning process that will take about a year for the full plan to be developed, but there are two phases to it. The first phase will be relatively quick. It's about how we downsize, how we strategically downsize. We know that, as the president said, that we have to reduce expenditures significantly, and we want to have that process be much more strategic for this coming year than it was over the past couple of months when we had to do things quickly and rapidly and asked everyone to take a 5% cut on their operating budget, as well as contributing reserves, as well as have an endowment or payout reduction. So the first phase will be about looking across the university administration, as well as academics, facilities, all aspects of the university. And how can we become more focused? How can we become more efficient and effective, thirdly? I would like to engage this group, certainly in terms of me reporting back to you. The current plan is to have three oversight committees, one for administration, that will look at how in administration we can take significant budget reductions to be more effective, not just Day Hall, but all administration across the university. The second will be academics. How can colleges and schools and departments be more focused rather than just shrinking in a random fashion? And then the third one is about students. We need to decide what our student enrollments are going to be, both undergrad and grad. We need to decide how we can be more effective in areas of student services, academic services for students. So we'll have those major task forces. And I would like to involve not all of you. You all don't need to and want to spend the next year doing this, but certainly this group needs to be represented, and I'd like to do that.
one other thing that Event has done that I at least want to make sure you're aware of in case you haven't known it, is that we've decided that whatever we're asking the campus to do, we're going to do more of in our own offices. So everyone's taking the 4.8% cut. We've taken 10% cuts in our offices. I've taken a voluntary 10% reduction in my compensation. I won't let that go back until I feel the university is beginning to turn a corner. And so we're not going to ask anybody to do anything more of. And once again, of this group, only one has sat through the vast majority of these discussions and can, when we're not going to tell you whether this stuff is true or not. One last thing, and that is the emphasis on planning. Planning any kind of social checkered history in higher ed, because our institutions all around the country in general have not gotten to be great because of planning. They've gotten to be great because individual groups and individual faculty and staff and function have just had their own aspirations and gone out and got their own resources and done what is necessary to attract students to research and scholarly activity and creative activity. So it goes against the very grain of academia to do anything top down.
Seems to me to be a useful way of thinking about it, rather than some a group of people saying, well, you know, sure you want to go in that direction, or, you know, rather thinking in terms of reformulating the foundation ideas away from that growth idea.
So since I won't be a part of the planning, but I'll be cheering from the sidelines, and then, you know, of course, I'll have a chance to get my two cents in since our offices are 10 feet apart, but still, it's Kent's process, and you all will be involved in it. When I say you all, I mean in the southern sense, not all you all. But anyway, it's such a complex calculus, Marty, what you're bringing up, such a complex calculus. You know, in academics, you always say something's complex when you don't want to answer the question. But I want to try to take a whack at answering some of the things that are embedded in what you're saying, because you and I have had exchanges about this, and I know how strongly you feel about a particular project and about the general project. So the three attributes, like I'm telling you something. So I've been in higher ed 31 years and you 38. We're both swaybacks, and at least I am. And you know this, so I almost hesitate to tell you something like I'm teaching you something, but just reminding you that one of the most pluralistic kind of organisms is a university campus done the right way. And pluralistic is a nice way of saying that if you get three people together, three faculty or three staff on a campus, and you ask them what time it is, they'll have an argument about what time zone are you talking about, why are you asking me that, we're talking about sundials or digital or what is it. And so the integration of that wonderful pluralism is the challenge. That's the challenge. And the closer you are to the planning process, the more you'll see this immediate challenge, just like you've known in arts and in music and all the places, the things that you've touched on campus. There are people on campus, for example, who write me and say the future of a university like this in terms of revenue is in making sure that we can take advantage of the huge, robust science funding coming down the pike from the federal government and from corporate foundations and so on for renewable energy. And we got to turn the ship toward renewable energy. That doesn't mean blow off the arts and humanities and so on. You know how I feel about that stuff. But let's make sure that we don't fail to take advantage of that. And it's strong rhetoric. It's based in reality in terms of the finances the country's putting into it. And if one wanted to follow that, then one is going to have, it could all be LEED gold, but you're going to have either new facilities or revamped facilities and so on. That's one logic. Another logic, which is equally obtains, Marty, in my point of view, is to say that if you have, as we have on campus now, $50 million of annual debt service, that if the debt service was less, then you'd have more money to spend on something else, assuming that the debt service money is coming out of funds that can be used for other purposes, suggesting that a choice should be made between, you know, people on the one hand and stuff on the other hand. And the actual answer is you can't make a clean, monolithic choice in a university setting. You can't do it. Because if you do, if you decide, let's only go after renewable energy on the one hand, or you decide, let's quash the debt service and spend all the money on people and let's agree not to grow in terms of buildings for 10 years, then either one of those decisions will change the university very fundamentally, not just in its built environment, but in the kind of faculty who will be recruited and retained. And so I believe in a two-step process, just as Kent outlined in terms of the budget cuts. The first thing we need to do is stop the music, talk to each other, figure out. I said that on purpose. Try to get a pun in here. Try to get a rise out of you. And say let's just everybody take a deep breath and talk and figure out what we're doing. That's what's happening right now. There is nothing going forward on the campus right now. Renovations, nothing. In fact, just in the last couple of days, the provost has come to me and said to me, because of your absolutism about this, David, there's things where we've made a promise to faculty, you're being hired and your lab is going to be renovated. We have all the money to pay for it. It's not in debt. And I said, nothing. Not a hammer goes into a nail. So we're going to have to make sure that I'm not hurting faculty and so on and so forth. But basically, all the big things like that are being slowed down. The plans that we presented to the board in great detail, and Bill sat through much, if not all of this, pulls back the debt service by something like 20% from currently planned projects already. So make no mistake about it. We're doing things in a much, much different way. But I would be so disingenuous if I didn't say to you that on a campus that has a lot of science in it, and I mean Lincoln Hall notwithstanding, where I'll be thinking about how rare it is to do that kind of a beautiful renovation, taking care of current structures has to be done. Occasionally, under the right set of circumstances, building new things for faculty has to be done. And occasionally, under the right circumstances, and sometimes involving debt, things have to be done for the student experience, like the West Campus, which was hugely influential in student satisfaction about the student life experience, and also enormously expensive. So all I'm saying is that it's complicated, and what we've chosen to do is do this brute force reduction of budget for right this minute so that we can begin to turn the ship. And then Kent has proposed this fascinating two-stage process of planning where the individual areas can think through, by their own local expertise, what makes sense. And then the provost, by his experience in general and higher ed, and in particular Cornell, can draw an umbrella over it and do that. But this is going to be one of the very key discussions that we have. And while we're having the discussion over the next several months, we're going to have to make some decisions about some of these things. For example, I have to make decisions in the next very few days about what to do about a handful of projects that I've stopped, just wanting to be sure that we're actually thinking about this very carefully. The second thing I want to remind you about, I think you know this, I don't mean to be talking just to you, but just because we know each other.
Everybody, I hope somebody's question over there.
Yeah, well, hopefully everybody has this question. I do. It keeps me up at night. I want to remind you that we've taken $300 million of aspirations on the campaign from buildings and moved it over to student financial aid and to professorships, mostly student financial aid. So we're voting with our feet, so to speak, not only in the halt, construction pause, but also in moving whatever 300 million over 4 billion is, 8% or I can't think, something like that, of the campaign has been shifted over from buildings to people, if you will, to students. And then the third thing is what opportunities will come up that we just don't know about now? What opportunities will come up in the non-science areas? What opportunities come up in the science areas, what opportunities will come up in interdisciplinary areas, that I think we can't tie each other's hands in thinking forward. In other words, we have to develop a process that once the plan is done, has to be a living, dynamic process or document or whatever the provost chooses to call it, that will be able to allow us to be flexible and agile and responsive to things changing, so that when faculty, as we often do, come forward and say, here's something I really think we ought to grab by the lapels and do something about it, that there'll be some wherewithal and flexibility to do that. And so those are the three things I think about. Stopping the music for right now and talking to each other and figuring things out. Moving resources in the direction of things that we all agree on right now. Like I believe, for example, student financial aid is an issue that there's very little disagreement on campus, at least that I've encountered. And then thirdly, to allow ourselves to realize that our best predictions are going to be at best noisy and imprecise, and that there needs to be some flexibility in the system to allow responsiveness to new aspirations and opportunities that come up. And then within that, we're just going to have to work it through thing by thing, person by person, initiative by initiative, project by project as they come up. I hope it's a fair recitation, Bill, of what the discussion we've been going through behind the scenes. And it's wide open. And it's very different now than it has been. And then we just have to see. This part is relatively easy, because during a crisis, for a few months, people will put up with almost anything, including really stopping everything. But you can't stop everything forever. And the question will be, how to handle it going forward. A great example of that, by the way, is people being willing not to take raises this year. I went to the faculty leadership and the staff leadership and said, how would you feel about not taking a raise this year if it will lower the number of layoffs? And it was, at least from the people I heard from, nearly unanimous that people said, we can go a year, especially because most of the peer schools are also not giving raises or much raises. But that's not a sustainable solution either. So, questions?
Yeah, Yeah.
I have a question about downsizing process. I work for alumni affairs and development, so we just went through our
huge
reorg. Unfortunately, it was actually sort of planned restructuring. But one of the things that we did, I think, was eliminated duplication of services already existed at the university.
Right.
For example, enforcing PIT and, you know, business service processes. Now, I know that years ago decisions were made to embed business service
right.
centers in all the colleges and units and to embed these little tech support areas. So do you see more consolidation of those types of services? And
yeah, here's a visionary thing that Kent has done in just a few weeks in the provost office. In developing the budget cuts for the VPs, because the VPs all took 4.8%, of course, like the deans of colleges did, except that we took 10. And in developing those cuts and approving them, Kent set up a sort of a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a template where people list, you know, how is my unit, how's Tommy's unit going to get to a 4.8% budget cut? How much will be done by not hiring into open lines? How much will be done by layoffs? And then we developed this a staff retirement incentive program, which of course is I think it's wonderful and can cut down on the number of layoffs. Thirdly, how much will be done by non-personnel actions and so on and so forth. And in that template, there was a category that said, how will your thinking about your own situation affect other parts of the university? So there's a formalized way of looking at this. I haven't looked at it in a few days, but I think in Charlie's plan for AA and D, there's interactions with Tommy's shop, with Mary Opperman in HR, I think, with CIT. There's
finance.
Ways of touching finance, ways of touching other parts of the university. So I guess if I'm thinking about it correctly, the administrative oversight part of the committee structure that you're setting up would be one place to deal with that question of consolidation, sharing. Is that right?
Yeah, and those administrative services, whether it's CIT or finance. But the alumni personal development is a great model for what we'd like to do across the campus, where you all have said that we can be, we need to be smaller with the sourcing function, as I call it, the budget, and making some tough decisions about how to reorganize. But then with that understanding, at some point you'll want to regrow, and for the sake of the university with resources. So you all are ahead of us, but it's a model that we want to follow for many other areas.
In between areas.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah, of course.
Which actually probably would be for Tommy. I mean, do you see...
Once you ask Tommy as many questions as you like.
...seeing more, you know, some of our stuff is sort of like...
Well, I think that.
I think
the answer to your question is, I mean, the division was created actually to support all the rest of the campus, and that's exactly what we're going to have to do. And from our perspective, I think that even though we're taking our cuts as well, and we're having to adjust to the adjustments around campus, because that means that some of our clients are less inclined. We know that we're going to have to be doing a lot more communication, so we're just going to have to be a lot more effective about that. But our job is to respond to you.
Questions? Please.
I'm actually curious about the bonds Cornell has decided to...
Uh-huh.
A couple of questions, I guess, three related questions. One of our peer institutions have done this. I thought I heard something that Princeton had decided to also...
Princeton and Harvard, between the two of them, have sold $2.5 billion of bonds already. Emory's doing it. Everybody is thinking about doing this. And we want to be very conservative in the amount of extra debt that we take on. So even though we're a bigger school than any of those schools, we have as many students in your undergraduate student body, on student aid, the whole student body at Harvard, we're going to take on much, much less, $500 million. So the basic maneuver, which is to sell these bonds, acquire this debt, and use that money as what you might call working capital, rather than continue to take money out of the endowment, it's just a chance that you take. The assumption is that eventually you make enough money by protecting the endowment over the years, not right now, more than the interest you pay back to bondholders in retiring the debt of the bonds. So that's the thought of it, yeah. If you look on I don't know if you're interested in this. I don't know what you're studying, Mark.
Economics.
Okay. you might sign up. By the way, the university also sells tax-exempt debt. That's the usual debt that we use for construction projects and so on, and also has lines of credit like your own personal credit card, except bigger, higher credit limit, and unfortunately. And one of the things that the provost is doing with the taking the money from uncommitted fund balances is paying down those lines of credit so that the university has a better overall balance sheet, overall credit status. But if you want to do something you might find interesting, especially during a period like this, where it's like, unfortunately, a big international laboratory of economics gone awry, is you could sign up for Bloomberg's higher ed, what do they call it? It's like a higher ed
report.
It's like a listserv, not a listserv exactly. It's a report. It's like an alerting service. And I'm not sure how much they would charge you to do it, but if it's not a lot, you'd find it fascinating because they report anything remotely related to the higher ed, including every time an institution goes on the bond market, they list all the details about it, many details that I don't actually understand all the inner workings of. And so you might find it interesting. If it's expensive and you want to look at a couple of them, I'm glad to forward mine to you if you could just send me an email and remind you. But I'm learning a lot by watching what's happening. But it's a very broad... it's interesting, too, the day that Bloomberg announced that we were going to enter the bond market, which was the day after I sent this note out to everybody, they had a listing of all the entities that day announced they were selling bonds. And there were many universities, and also Microsoft, and Merck, and the country of Poland, and the country of Russia, and the country of Vietnam. And so I think, from the little that I understand about it, I think what must be happening is that there are so few relatively safe places that people can put money that a lot of entities think that things that are obviously not going to go away, hopefully, are not going to default, like the country of Russia, can sell. My family's from Russia, so I hope it would be very embarrassing to my sainted father if Russia defaulted. But thinking that people would think it's a relatively safe place to put funds, I think universities like Cornell will rise to the top of people's thinking that after 144 years, almost 145 years, it's unlikely that we're not going to return payment on bonds. But it's ubiquitous. It's as close to, I think that was the right word. Yeah. You should check this Bloomberg thing out. It's amazing.
I would think that our alumni have a very strong interest in
they do.
Investing back. Or is there a strategy you guys have developed
yep.
to let all the alumni know
yep.
about this?
Yep. Tommy is, by the way, this is Tommy's moment in the sun in a time where, seriously, where communication is 95% of what it'll take to have us pull together as a community. Tommy's working on things. Tomorrow, for example, I think it's tomorrow, we're doing the first of a video deal,
right.
But we're going to have some sort of electronic interaction so that I can spend less money traveling and so on and still reach alumni. And one of the things we're going to tell them is, here's the stuff, and as soon as we know how you can buy it, in the faculty meeting, Elizabeth and Marty, people were asking, where do you buy the bonds? I was at an alumni event somewhere in the last couple of weeks, and people said, how do we find out? I think it was in San Francisco, how to invest in Cornell bonds. So we'll let people know, and I hope it'll be tomorrow, actually tomorrow, but it will be soon. Yep.
So the higher educational side, community facing unique set of services, how much coordination is Cornell engaged in with other universities of similar size or similar endowment size, and how much influence do we have on their process? To make sure that we're in coordination to stay competitive for the right students and the right size of the talent.
It's a really complicated question. There's over 4,000 institutions of higher education in the country. Over 4,000, fewer than 100 have an endowment of $1 billion or more. So first you have to just remember that you guys are in a tiny little slice of American higher education. 250 research universities. The Ivy League is 8 schools, and if you add, MIT, Stanford, University of Chicago, a couple other places, then you have still a small group. And then within that group, there's this fairly broad variation of very wealthy schools of the ratio between the size of the student body, size of the faculty body, and the overall endowment size. So there's a lot of communication. I, the president, send each other, you know, copies of our boring letters to the communities, and we lie to each other and say, gosh, that was a fabulous letter. And then they write me and they say, you did a great job, knowing full well that, you know, Tommy wrote it, but whatever. Do all these kind of things. But what you can't do because of restraint of trade legislation, because of antitrust legislation, we can't sit around the table and say, well, let's all gouge the students the same way. Let's all, you know, let's all compress the faculty at the upper ranks the same way. You just can't do that. And so we don't talk in advance about things we're going to do. We find out from each other's schools. But general principles of what has already happened and the thinking that people do, we do largely, our school does largely in a group called the AAU, which is 62 most robust research universities, if that's a fair description, right, in the U.S. and Canada. And people have compiled sort of like a matrix, you know, of here's all the levers you could pull and here's all the schools. And they're amazingly similar, amazingly similar. A lot of the schools have slowed down construction. Harvard ground to a halt its Alston project, which is going to be 1 million square feet of high-quality life science space, an enormous new campus for Harvard. No raises or almost no raises. I guess Harvard's not hiring faculty right now, if I'm not mistaken. So it's interesting. But if you get out of the rarefied air of the Ivy League and you go into state schools right now, it's fascinating. It's much different because those schools do not depend on the endowment because they have these, you know, big student bodies, large tuition pools because of student body and tiny endowments. And so they're not doing as many, I don't know what the word is, sort of draconian things, or whatever the right word is, as we are here. So so in that sense, you can't actually coordinate in a prospective way because of the restraints of trade. The communities of shared governance organizations in general don't talk to each other in a very organized way. Faculty tend to get together through the AAUP and other faculty organizations, but I don't know, for example, how often, Bill, you get together, if ever, with AAU presidents of faculty senates. And I'm assuming it's. I think students actually do have some more coordination or at least discussion between student body presidents, SA presidents, but this place has a very robust set of official shared governance things where, even though a small number, there's actually students voting on the trustees, staff voting on the trustees, faculty voting on the trustees, and so on, dean of faculty going to executive committee, stuff like that. But the real power of the overall higher ed community, either in the bureaucratic ranks like me, or in the shared governance ranks, or in the rank and file ranks, is not tapped in general. And, you know, one of the discouraging things is when you do see higher ed out in the public domain as a group, I think we tend to just whine a lot about how we need more resources. That's my own point of view. At a time when the country needs us to really help do all the right things, that is, be able to supply education to people who still can afford it and want to go work through economic development schemas in regional areas like upstate New York, that are suffering unbelievably in this downturn. Outside the campus walls, you know, things are so much worse. And so I'm hoping, in using whatever bully pulpit I can with Tommy's good offices, to try to get the word out that this is our chance to really, as a community, broadly, like you're talking about, help, you know, help get the country moving in the right direction by doing all the right things. So that's a little broader answer, but I hope it answers the question in general.
I want to bring together several things in thinking about this. Do you think? I mean, we've had our president of the United States talking about there's been a period of excess, if you want to say.
Sure.
You know, sort of boiled down a couple of things he said, and the excess is obviously in the financial area, but it spreads also into others, and it seems. And I started out my question thinking about, you know, possibly an excess here, and
sure,
in not just expecting more revenue to come in, but thinking about what we can,
right,
do with more revenue.
Right.
As opposed to conservation, but not in the button-down sense, but in the sense of, you know, appropriate use of resources.
Uh-huh.
you know, small is beautiful kind of thing. Not small campus necessarily, but thinking about small projects, you know, not the, you know, the megabucks computer, big, you know, room-sized computer, but the personal computer, which then frees up people, you know, much more. Those kinds of, those kinds of economies of scale, I guess. Do you think that higher education as a whole got sucked into a kind of, at least a wedge of consciousness, a portion of the consciousness that infected markets in the United States in other areas, financial markets, for example? Do you think that Cornell has that as a possibility as well? You know, we love Cornell. I'm not trying to blacken its name, but is it possible if there's a rethinking of certain fundamental things that needs to go on? I love the carbon initiative, those things which are really beginning to recalibrate how we approach our resources, human resources, natural resources. Is there something also in the financial area that could be thought about that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a pregnant question. I mean, first I would say, I don't want to talk for an hour, although I'd like to do that, because that eats up time that you could ask me tough questions, but first of all, I think, I wouldn't say this about you because I don't know you well enough to know, but I think many of us as individual human beings have just lived beyond our means. And you can see that in the ratio of debt to savings in the United States across, you know. So I think, number one, it's not just higher ed, it's not just, you know, this or that. I mean, we all is a strong word, but many of us, and as a society, tend to live beyond our means. And that's one sort of mentality that all of us assume our salaries are going to go up, whatever, so on and so forth. And so I think there's a general mentality of figuring it's okay to live a little bit on debt, or more than a little bit on debt, or a lot on debt, and let's have some enjoyment and higher quality of life now, and so on and so forth. And so naturally, since universities are comprised of human beings, there is this thought that if we could go forward and have a bigger campus, a brighter campus, a shinier campus, better things, everything, student services, faculty support, why not do it if we can afford it? If it looks like we can reach an equilibrium, why not do it? And then we're talking, Marty, about 20, 30, 40 years, not 4 or 5 years. We're talking about since the government set up federal science agencies after World War II, the NIH has gone like this, and if you look at biomedical research and so on, and during the doubling of the NIH budget, everybody, University of Iowa where I was, with basically no endowment, and Cornell here, everybody was saying, let's try to help the highest ideals, let's try to find preventive methods in medicine, let's try to find cures for horrible loathsome diseases, and let's do it through the you know, highest aspirations of science. I can't argue against that, even though it ends up making some rooms full of computers and you know, bioinformatics and so on. I think it's hard to get in the way of people translating equilibrium finances into big aspirations. And if there was ever a campus where I think I could argue with you strongly that there might be a place for a room full of computers, it's at Cornell, which is one of the leading computing places in the world. Okay, but you're asking a deeper and better question.
I was thinking about the mainframe versus
right.
was also thinking...
But wait, let me finish. So you're asking, I think, if I could rephrase or paraphrase what you're asking, I just had to say that thing about computers because I don't know if everybody else understands it the same way. But one thing that I would say is embedded in your question is, are we able to revisit the values that established a university like this in the first place? I think that's what you're really asking.
Right.
And so I'll tell you what my values are instead of trying to speak for the campus. I think we were set up, number one, to teach students. And so my number one priority is to have sufficient financial aid that we don't wash people out of the market for thinking about a Cornell education. And so you'll probably see more than any other signature of what I'm trying to do to pay attention to accessibility for students. And the board agreed unanimously to allow us to take $35 million a year out of the endowment to up financial aid. We're the only school that I'm aware of that greatly upped financial aid in the middle of the market going down in October. And so that's one value that we have to return to on campus, is making sure that we're thinking about accessibility for students and not allowing the nature of the student body to move more and more and more toward privileged you know, people who have been privileged for generations. And I admit a lot of that is a personal thing, since I'm a first-generation college student, first-generation American. I'm seeing it through my own eyes, as everybody does. So I'm with you that I think we need to recalibrate, to use your word, in that way. Secondly, I'm with you on the idea that we need to take care of the built environment on campus as our very first priority. And once again, you'll just have to see what unrolls, but you're going to see a much, much slower pace of new projects in the future. But thirdly, I have to say it won't be zero, because you just can't zero out a campus like this that has so much good things going on. But I'm envisioning a campus, and this is a vision, not a strategy or tactic. It's easy for me to talk about this stuff, Marty. The provost and the operational leaders of the campus, with your consultation, have to figure out what it actually means. But I believe that both Kent and I share the aspiration and the vision. Campus should be living within its means, that there should always be flexibility, that we shouldn't live to the hilt of our credit limit, that we should be open and consultative, that we should be a more focused campus, that administration should account for a smaller proportion of the action financially than it does now. And so I think in those ways we are returning to the conceptualization of the campus as a place that held the values to people as the highest value. But the nuances of looking at every single individual decision is going to be where the campus will not agree totally. And that will be the part, if I'm not misinterpreting, where Kent will be taking advantage of the elected expertise, and there will be disagreement. There will be wild disagreement about exactly what to do in individual cases. But I hope that we will first come together as a campus in those aspirations. And one thing I wish you would do, you plural would do, is look back at those five overarching aspirations that we worked out with the deans and the VPs a year and a half ago. Biddy had a big hand in that. And look at them, and let the provost know what you think about them, because that's the headline under which we're operating right now. And that, and those headlines are student access, enabling faculty creativity, supporting enabling faculty creativity, being a good employer, the sort of employer that we can be proud of, treating our people right, like this retirement incentive thing, I think, is a great example of that. And another big piece of that is running the campus in a responsible way, you know, having responsible stewardship of the campus. And so the basic sentiment of what you're saying, I'm 1,000% there. The question will be how to translate that in a very pluralistic environment to be supportive of the many communities that have many different points of view.
Thank you all for coming today. I guess my question is more for Provost Kent.
Good.
And a little bit about what you had mentioned. Perhaps I missed it. I don't know if I maybe misunderstood it, but what was exactly the second part, I guess, of the process? You mentioned the downsizing.
Yeah, I didn't say much about the second part. That's the fun part. That's how we get to dream. Document our aspirations, come up with strategies and tactics for achieving those aspirations, think about metrics for measuring our progress. So the first part is the hard part, and that's living within our means. The second part is our goals for the long-term future, how we can make Cornell the very best in the areas that we're going to focus on. So we'll start that process in the fall. And that we hope to be finished with that in the spring, a year from now. Yeah, so that's what I would call, and I think the president would call, a more traditional institutional strategic plan, where you're talking about excellence and growth, and not what rarely happens in a planning process is where you talk about strategic downsizing, and that's what we're doing right now for the next few months. But the fall is the fun part.
So yes. Going along with that, you had also mentioned the three oversight committees, and
yes.
I think just judging from looking at the Cornell Sun in the past few days, and
yes.
other articles that come up. A lot of things that students are mentioning, you know, accountability one, also representation for say in these committees. You had mentioned that, you know, there will be representation
yep.
if you're interested.
Yep.
So I'm just a little bit more curious about, you know, the process are going about setting up these committees, specifically the size, because definitely I think all of us can agree, especially students would agree, that that student representation, not just on the student committee, but just on all the committees as well,
yep,
give our input about the issue.
This is the tension around size and effectiveness of these committees. They frankly can't be really large. So one of the issues that I have to deal with is how do we engage and get, you know, all the great ideas that are sitting out here amongst our employees, amongst our faculty and the students, and have them participate in the process, but yet not have a cumbersome process, because we don't have a lot of time. We really don't. So that is that's the great challenge we have over the next few weeks, is coming up with that process. Remember that it's not just three committees. Those are actually just the oversight groups. Underneath that will be task forces. So there'll be one on student enrollment. There'll be another one in administration around information technology. There'll be a task force for every college. Every college is going to have one of these about how the college can be more focused and decide in what areas they're going to downsize or have their resources, what things do they do that aren't efficient or effective. And then there'll be some overarching task forces as well. But there's the three oversight groups, I call them, and then under those are a bunch of others. So there'll be one in the humanities and arts. There'll be another one in physical sciences and engineering, another one in life sciences, looking at themes across colleges.
You were first.
I'm still really worried, but I can't imagine
to be in charge of things. Very nice thing to say.
Thank you, Elizabeth. You made my semester.
Just one thing, though. Obama's popular. So Obama might start
on the way.
But I think something else is coming, right?
But really, these are the things that are coming back to haunt us that do represent previous decisions. I think you guys are really off the hook for it. That, you know, without putting people in the stocks and trying to make that, but in any way, been gone again. just kidding. it's really important to recognize how the mistakes are made. And I think we're doing this. You know, I'm a student of national politics, too. And I'm just so convinced, as my life goes on, more than I've ever been before, that an open and truly deliberative process is very easy to make decisions. And that's why democracy works better than any other system, because you hear more voices. Mm-hmm. And I can think of some really bad decisions from the past that were made by two people or one person, really not listening to the student assembly and the faculty and the town and so on, and just not hearing at all. And I don't expect to be them. I really don't. Because y'all let me down. But because, you know, in the past, when the administrators talk about consultation, we use that word a lot. And be careful when you use that word, because it usually meant showing us a slideshow of what they were going to do. And this is what they call consultation. And there was never any ability to stop anything that one was worried about. So real consultation really is in the word. And I do really like the idea of putting students back on the executive committee, which is where they used to be. And I know, you know, a lot of faculty and teachers that if you can only put one new person on there, I think put the students on there. Because they're the consumers here, and they're the people most affected by this. And maybe they're their voice. It's different from having, you know, five or six different trustees all kind of looking at things in the same way. The growth of administration you mentioned also, I mean, if one looks over time, I remember sitting in the studio a couple of years ago, if you look at what's growing, it's not faculty, it's not students, and so much of it, you know, central administration, and they all be ledger, you know, those are resources, and they all, the thing is, it's not just the resources that are going into administration, rather than students and faculty, it's the fact that the more administration there is, the heavier the hand of decision making, and the less opening up and saying, help us with this decision, but when you get to, you know, a certain tipping point, it's all just, you know, made with news and they all. And John Ehrenberger and also somebody in my department who really looked at funding and higher education have pointed out something that I sort of heard you say, you know you're saying it, but the notion of building versus student group faculty. And I mean, both Ron and Susanna think that there really has been a trade-off. And if you look at tuition increases of, and again, I think this is the best thing that we're doing this time, is putting that priority on the student financial aid. It's just the very best thing for the whole country not to make this such an egregious institution. And that, I really do compliment you on that. But overall, it limits the higher education spending. One sees all this spending on hardware, on buildings, and tuition just going up, always far more than inflation. And I really do applaud you on the financial aid. But, you know, the overall goals here, some decision-making structure that will always help us keep our eyes on the big picture and what all these trade-offs are. And if we spend all this money on building, what might then be severely handicapped? Because I mean, I have to reiterate to you, in my department, we can't hire anybody to teach law in a government department. And the mobile number of our students at law school, we have nobody to teach constitutional law. I mean, we're really cutting, you know, we're eating our seed corn here. And we're cutting the number of graduate students. Not, you know, student undergrads may stay, but graduate students, that's a really big cut. And good heavens, that has to be really central to our purpose. We don't have enough to have a critical mass of American college people to talk to each other in college. But just, you know, looking at the overall goals and some way of having a consultative, really deliberative, let me say deliberative consultative process, when you really hear other people, might help us to look at that. And to not just to mention what something nitty-gritty that is the sign of bad decision-making, the way we have in the past gotten really hung up on parking lots. If there was any central thing this university seemed to stand for, it was always having a lot of central campus parking lots. And I remember when the decision was made in Red Bull, $100 to go to the office, and he received those that there and said, okay, now here are the number of parking spaces that have been lost to recent construction, and of course, lots of construction. And so here are the number of new spaces we need in new parking lots. And it was all just dollars and cents about parking lots. And we said at meetings of the university building, which that goal of never losing a parking space from some sort of ideal point of lots of parking spaces 10 years ago, never losing a parking space, is the goal I have heard cited most often in budget decisions, really. And that just flies in the face of sustainability. We don't need both a giant new, parking lot on Forest Home Drive, and also a giant new three-tier parking lot by the Millstein building. I hope that we will leave it, because that's also a decision made by two people, as far as I know. You know, Gideon, AAP. But we've got to have some kind of big picture and not get hung up on little things like saving the number of parking spaces, but look at the big picture of what university stands for. But I want to give you one more comment. I think I emailed you about this. I think one of the great things that you can do that don't really cost very much money is going to Orlando. I think it was wonderful that you went to Orlando. You took our university to Orlando, and you made a statement for openness and that's a really good thing. That's the university.
And you took some heat for it, right?
Yeah, a little bit. But thank you for saying all that. There's only one thing I would take issue of all those different things, and how can you bite the hand that pets you? But I think looking back on the individual decisions that were made by Biddy and Don Randall and Mel Nesh, I mean, I've gone back a long ways to look at these decisions, and they're all friends of mine. In fact, I met Mel, just a fascinating, I just can't help but love to tell vignettes, which is Tommy's like to strangle me because I use up time with him. But anyway, I have the floor. So I met Mel in, of all places, in Thailand. The Thai government, long time ago, years and years ago, asked two Americans to consult for the Thai government on the way they run their 24 public universities, and they asked Mel and me, and we got to know each other in Bangkok. And of course, I knew nothing about Thailand. It was the most terrible consulting thing to take a national system. You bring somebody in here who's never been there, nothing about it, and say, you've got to listen to these people. So, right, it was just horrible. And Mel had this wonderful attitude where he said, gosh, all I can tell you is how we do things at Cornell. And you have to decide, does that make any sense for your culture here? What do you think? So I went back and looked at those decisions. And here's how I think they were made in general. In defender or humans. He didn't say the decision. But here's how I think they were made. I think in general, parking lots are not. Actually, nobody's ever brought up parking lots to me in a financial sense. In the whole three cycles I've been here, not once ever has somebody said that that was a driving force, you know, for a budgetary decision. Maybe those decisions were all made before my time. But here's what I think happened in general. I think that a group of some kind, a faculty group or a student group or people who represent student services or something, in the case of West Campus, came forward and said, we think this would be a great idea. There was some discussion about it. Maybe the discussion did or didn't involve broader deliberative processes, he suggested, but there was a discussion about it. And then a minority of those ideas rose to the top of the list. Many of them were rejected. Most of them were rejected. And then a minority rose to the top. And then the critical examination was, given a backwards look at finances and a forward extrapolation of financial trends to the period of time of actually not only hiring the faculty, beginning the initiative, building the structure, but operating and paying for the debt involved, can it all make sense? And extrapolating without 95% confidence limits, just extrapolating in a linear fashion from what happened before, I believe in every single case the belief was that there would be sufficient funds to do it without disrupting the equilibrium of the campus. And I'm not saying that to whitewash anything or cover anything up. That's what I actually believe. And I went back three administrations of provost to see. And I believe that's how they were done in general. I didn't look at every single decision, but I looked at samples and I looked at the statistics that I could find as transparent as they were. You know, times vary in terms of transparency and whether things are expressed in cash or accrual accounting or all these kind of vagaries. I don't think there were very many major expensive decisions made by just a single person or two people. I really don't. I do believe that there were decisions made, as in every administration, where someone eventually had to say, yes, let's pull the lever on this decision. But I think there was an honest belief, and somebody who's been here a longer time should tell me if I'm just looking at this wrong. You were 6 years with Mfitti. Honest belief that there would be a financial equilibrium possible based on extrapolation of the past. Is that fair?
I think so. I think we rely too much, though, on the hope of philanthropy.
Yeah, growth in all kinds of things. Yeah. Earnings on the endowment, philanthropy, tuition going up, as you said, Elizabeth, the 3.5% above inflation for the last two decades, and so on. And so if you take Marty's point and extrapolate that point to saying, let's go back and visit our assumptions, there was a time at Cornell where the tuition was inflation plus, I forgot, a point or two. In other words, that there was a more rigid following of the CPI plus a point or two to make it real for higher education, as opposed to just dreaming up whatever the market would bear that year. So that's the reason that I have not looked backwards or pointed fingers. And the reason that I took a 10% hit on my salary is that I was the last teacher. And I also been here almost 3 years now. And somehow, you know, I didn't pay enough attention to this when I immediately got here. So I think it's really good for the campus. What's the word I'm looking for? I'm not usually so at a loss for words, but I think it's better for the campus spirit and better for the deliberative process if we can return to the basic values that we all can agree on, like looking at those five overarching aspirations, talk with each other, develop a process of, that deliberation is a great word, that is at one and the same time effective, as inclusive as can be without making it cumbersome, so we end up having some massive thing that gets us nowhere. And then revisit it a lot once the decisions are made. Look at it, be transparent about the results, not just monetary results, but the human results. For example, we up the financial aid, but what is the actual yield of students applying? It's fascinating that this year we actually had almost a 4% further increase in student applications for new students, despite the fact that the trend's going in the opposite direction in some of the country's finest liberal arts colleges. But look at metrics like that to see, does all the logic pan out when you actually look at what's, you know, how people are behaving? And operate in that way based on principles and looking forward as a community, rather than spending any time trying to figure out whether a particular decision was bad because of the content of the decision or the process. I do think that Kent has made, and actually David Harris, to be fair, I think you would agree, but in the month that he was interim provost, David made enormous progress in opening up the books to the community.
He started it,
opening up the books. And when I say community, I mean to the dean of faculty, to everybody, so that we could actually see in detail what was in those extrapolations. And the fact that David is a social scientist and used to dealing with noisy data that's hard to get your arms around as you are, I think is an advantage for the university now, because these are extrapolations that are done with broad confidence limits and a lot of noise and projections. And so I'm really optimistic that we're in a good place to go forward now. What keeps me up night, honestly, is the fact that we have to get through this rocky period of downsizing, hopefully in a strategic way, that we will have, at least for a while, a smaller workforce. And it's hard. It's hard for the community internal to the university. It's hard for the community outside the walls of the university. It's hard for the whole upstate region, because we're such an outsized presence here. But I think we're set to go forward. And if we're not, if we're doing things that are adverse, you have my email address, both you guys, and everybody has it. And Kent's as accessible as I am. More accessible. He works longer hours. I tend to go home and be with the dogs and work my home. Kent is here.
Sends me emails.
I just wanted to comment on some factors. I mean, growth is very complex. The factors that drive growth are complex. So I just want to mention, too, I mean, if you think about something like the West Campus Initiative, I went to college in the 80s, of course, but provisions for students were so minimal. I mean, if you think about the dorm room, I mean, you know, it was like a bare room with a bed and an electrical outlet. And now, you know, nobody has personal computers. Now, every student has a laptop. They need this, they need that, they need wireless, they need, you know, there are types of student services that didn't exist back then, you know, especially for students with disabilities, the night writing students, and all these other. So the expectations of parents and students, the faculty as well, are much higher than they were about what students actually get, which then causes, you know, the need to want athletic facilities and the whole thing. That's one. And the other is, when we talk about administration, there's been a real change in fields of knowledge, and here I can, you know, point to Tommy's group. And if you think about what communications used to be 20 years ago, there was probably a press office, and it was probably mostly print, well, maybe not, mostly print communications. Now we have, you know, print publications, we have the web, we have a global communication strategy which requires more people to staff it. I mean, there is probably a point where there's too much, but I think you look at things like administration, when you look at those types of changes and, you know, world communication, that's probably
what's driving. Well, what brings your two lines of thought together is, I think my interpretation in the couple months that it's been fun to work with Kent, is what he just said a half hour ago here, and that is to strategically downsize, by which I always take your meaning, Kent, to be to get to some baseline that you're comfortable with, and then to look at growth in the university in a more rational way, which is what you guys are not saying, there should never be growth, but to make it rational and to follow principles. And so if you're the person who's the budget officer who's going to do it that way and is willing to be open. By the way, the point that you brought up, do you go by Alex or Alexander? Okay. Thanks. It's good. Or you probably go by Mr. Friedman. So. or your immenseness. It would be really great if there was some way to have crosstalk broader in the higher education community so that we could all return to values that we would find. And I think that there's a little, of course I'm paid to be an optimist, but I do think that there's some little glint of that in seeing that the other Ivies have also raised tuition less. All the Ivies have raised tuition, you know, less than 30, 40 years, although it's still greatly beyond inflation. There is some trend in that direction, and I guarantee you that was not by any sort of planned thing, because the attorneys don't even let us sit in the room and talk about tuition. So I think there is a consciousness that we just can't do this thing that Ehrenberg points out in his book, Tuition Rising, of 3 and 3.5% beyond inflation. And so I think we will go. The operative point is Kent's point that we can't take a long time to recalibrate the immediate thoughts of how we're going to act a year from now. How we're going to act 4 months from now has more or less been decided, in the sense that the cuts have been passed out, the cuts have come back, they've been approved by the two of us, Pence distributed that to the deans, and so everybody knows what everybody else is doing. We're compiling a list of how many jobs will be lost. We're waiting to see the results of the retirement incentive program to see how many folks are going to take, you know, voluntary way of separation from the university with some financial backing. And then the very next thing is the strategic downsizing, as Kent puts it, and then the very next thing is to think as a community going forward. And the only gravel in the gears during that period of time is whatever few decisions will have to be made on construction or renovation, like these faculty things that I've been stopping, we're going to have to find an open process to the community of a way to make some of those decisions so that the whole campus isn't ground to a halt while they're doing the planning process. And I will tell you openly in public that I'm getting some heat from that right now, because I've made the decision so absolute to stop everything. And we're discussing it, you know, sort of as we're speaking, we talked about it this week a couple of times, about what is reasonable to go forward with. I can maybe take one more. I've got to have dinner with the crew at the Becker House tonight.
I have a question for Kent. About, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, the College of Architecture and Planning almost was absorbed by other colleges and schools on campus.
Yes. I remember those posters.
Yeah. are any colleges or schools currently being looked at to be? Are we still going to have 7 colleges and schools? And the downsizing, is that going to change as well?
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm starting with no preconceived notions.
Okay, so you're looking at it.
And I'm asking that's more of a faculty issue, I view. That's not an administration issue. But I'm asking the faculty to not take anything off the table. Be creative, think about it. But smaller doesn't mean inefficient. I mean, smaller is more efficient. So I want us to think very, that there's a little white paper that I've asked Bill Fry to meet with me tomorrow and talk about, and that is for the colleges, and it asks, you know, what departments should maybe merge, what departments should stop, and things like that. Just tough decisions.
Okay.
We may not do any of them, but I want us to be creative and use this forcing function to put us in the right spot, knowing that our resources are going to be less for a few years.
Okay.
Yep. So,
thanks. Forgive me, Rodney, I got to go to this later.
Fine, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Tonight I'm going to listen. We're going to have a little talk about ethics with the Becker kids, and then I'm going to, the first time I'm going to see a live beatbox performance, which I'm so old, you know, I'm in a musician. I've been a musician for, 50 years, almost 50 years. And they said, do you want to perform tonight with a beatbox performance?
And what
I
is
said,
that?
And I said, well,
why not?
See, why not? That's the thing. You know, he's only been doing this for 3 months. You never admit you don't know something.
It's a
beatbox. You don't say beatbox. If you don't know what it is, you say, is that a type 1 or type 2 beatbox? People say, like, oh, well, I don't know. I got to go look it up. You know, but so I tried that. I said, is it type 1 or type 2 beatbox? And they said, what are you talking about? There's no type 1 beatbox. So my son just graduated Stanford, so he's my first son. And I said, he said, Dad, and he sent me like a ton of these YouTube things of people doing beatbox, and I said, oh, that's a beatbox. You know what a beatbox is, Hatch?
Yeah,
see? He's a music guy.
Adam Matta, right? Adam Matta,
yeah, right. Bruce Levitt's kid.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, so luckily, I did not bring any instruments, because that would have really been bad. One time at Iowa, we had the Susan Murphy equivalent, and I did that kind of a rap that was popularized in that movie, 8 Mile, what do you call that? Whatever that kind of thing where two people are battling each other.
Could you like show us?
No, I didn't. But we did it. We did it. We did it in front of the students, you know? And the students were so bored by it.
Oh.
There were like 1,500 students. They were so bored by it. They looked at us on stage for a while. They just turned and started talking to each other. They didn't even leave. They just turned and started talking. And then started talking to each other. So anyway, I'm going to have dinner. I'm going to listen to Adam Matta, and I'm going to have a little talk about ethics and student body. So I appreciate this. Tell me we'll get it together again. See you guys.
Thank you.
Give my regards to Dave as you're going out the door. Please,
yes.
Okay. Let's head back to the agenda for what little time we have left. Any reports from the essay? Okay. GP essay?
Yeah.
We have completed our charter review, and it's got to go out to all the staff to vote on.
And faculty center.
Bill, go ahead. Yeah, I have something to say. That's fine. No report from the faculty center. Unless you have my.
I need the resolution that you authored, Ms. Elizabeth.
Yes. Well, I'll have Elizabeth say a word about it. We had a resolution that was passed by the faculty center, right?
That is just a prayer for for more deliberation on the facilities and lining up the funding before you make a commitment to the debt. And we just actually saw some regards today from Notre Dame. They apparently have something like what we're asking for.
Right, 100% funding of all buildings before they go forward, including maintenance funding before they go forward. That was a resolution passed by the faculty senate. And then also with sustainability as a important concern in the development of them, of the building, as a central issue.
Are they saying that they passed that resolution? Are they sending it directly to Dr. Scorton, or are they asking for support from UA or anybody else?
It has gone well. I mean, it has gone to both programs.
We can bring that resolution to the UA to talk about. As I brought an earlier version to the UA, would you be interested? It's a straw poll. People would be interested in having us talk about that. All right. So we'll bring it to the next meeting, and the UA can wait and think about it. Thanks for prompting us.
Hey, so do you want to?
Yeah, I was just gonna say I forget exactly what was said last time we met or where we fell in the process. So assembly, one of the things we're undergoing right now is analyzing the process of funding student groups. Someone knows that I think Appendix B.
Appendix
A. So it's our Appendix A, and we have sort of a committee that's going to read over how that process is outlined. We're also running on Google as well. So.
There is something that Seth Pardo sent us as a report from the GPSA. Can I read it? There are three small points. First is they're in the process of updating their charter, making significant progress to streamline a clearer document. The Assembly recently passed a resolution in support of the LGBT Resource Center and continued attention to making sure that the appropriate level of staffing is found to maintain a high level of support for LGBT graduate professional students. A copy of the resolution should be up on Assembly's page soon, if not already. Third, the Advocacy Committee, AC, capital AC, is very active this semester, organizing town hall meetings and focus groups to gather community feedback on important issues, including transportation and housing. Were you going to say that?
Oh. Yes, sir.
And that is that the Senate is considering a change in the academic calendar. Making all of the constituent groups have been consulted in the best way in the GPSA, the EA, have all been consulted about it. It's a fairly minor change at this point, but it is that to start classes on Wednesday instead of Thursday in the fall semester. And a corollary will be to consider whether to take an additional, a compensatory day off. And it seems to me that the two likely days would be Labor Day as a non-class day, or the alternative to that would be the Wednesday before Thanksgiving as a non-class day.
Which is half day.
Which is a half day. Right. So that is an issue that I expect a resolution for the Senate meeting and probably a vote at the next meeting.
One could also say that there was some interest in having both 1.5 both days expressed, whether if it was possible in the calendar. But just to throw that in there in case people want to talk to their senators.
And then just and an addendum to our last meeting dealing with Cornell. So I met with Margie and Gary yesterday to kind of discuss a little bit more in depth what we discussed here. And with what they've requested, and I agree with this, is to get together a group of faculty, any faculty here that are interested in kind of, we discuss basically the roles of students, the faculty, and of the store, and kind of making a transparent textbook cycle, what each actor can do to kind of enhance the overall, I suppose, smoothness of that cycle, ensuring that maximum number of used textbooks can be purchased. So I'm going to organize a meeting bring faculty that are interested and those representatives from the Cornell store to kind of bounce ideas back and forth. I believe I had sent an email. We should have the email motions.
Speak if that's Michael Markham.
There's a good chance of it. Okay, I'll send another one. But so if anybody's interested.
Also, going off last meeting, Seth Pardo scheduled a meeting with Sarah Dipman. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
Sharon.
For next Wednesday, April 1st, 9:30 a.m., if anyone's interested, he said to email them. They will be discussing the BUHS structure.
Is there like a set time that we have where that's going to be, that resolution's going to be ready? Because we're quickly running out of meetings this year.
I just received an email from him, so I'm
not I just saw that, because she copied me on, or he copied me on that, so.
And then next meeting, I guess we're doing Gorge Safety.
Yes.
CJC, we have been waiting to have some time to tackle this issue. The next meeting, we have ample time to discuss. I'm working to make sure different groups are represented in that discussion, as well as CPD, ASA, and SA, as well as friends of the board, and Board Safety Committee.
So we're scheduling all the safety here.
And also, side note, last night we had another CJC meeting, and there is many more topics of business that they would like to cover before the end of the year, changes to the code that they would like to be passed. Minor changes, not major changes, but if we could fit that in before the end of the year, we can talk after.
Good CJC going. Okay, what does the acronym of BUSA?
I know
BUHS. BUHS.
Would you please get CJC to submit all of the proposed changes to the office so they can go out to us at least a week beforehand, before our meeting? Somewhere, yes, but he's talking about others.
Oh, for him. Yeah, I think that would be a
single issue.
Once the new ones are drafted in resolution.
Yeah, but in other words, I think it's a little bit beyond us to be able to handle something that's just brought to the meeting, even a day or so before the meeting. I think it should be well before the meeting so we have time to think about it and then make it more efficient in the meeting.
We also have minutes from the last meeting that we need to approve. So do I have someone to move? Mark? Who seconded? Kate? All in favor? That's unanimous. And any other items people want to discuss?
Just want to give a recap. We did have a group of union members and myself meet the week before spring break to discuss looking at the dormant committee structure and how to deal with that situation, because there are quite a few committees that haven't met in 4 years. And what came out of that was a consensus, at least in that group, that the University Assembly should probably do a comprehensive review and overhaul of its entire charter and really take into consideration about what structures in the committees and for the Assembly itself might help to make things more effective, more productive, and also better reflect the areas that the campus community is focused on now, because maybe some of those standing committees don't need to be standing committees at all, because the issues that they were set up to deal with are not standing issues anymore. So I think we discussed that's going to help put together a resolution, but that hasn't happened yet.
I'd like to consider that next meeting.
I like that idea a lot. I had sent an email, I guess it was probably last summer even, that I thought the best way of going about this kind of process was to change over to kind of an ad hoc committee structure, as we have effectively had in the past however many years. It's just that it's not formally institutionalized that way.
So I don't know if it would be appropriate maybe to offer another informal meeting like that to be discussing, or
I throw that out to the broader consideration. Basically, when we looked at it, we saw a lot of things broken in very different ways. There isn't an easy way solution. It's going to take a constructive approach that we think needs to start with not completely a blank sheet, but it needs to be built from the ground up. And we have many templates we can follow. But the first thing that needs to be decided by the body is, are we going to undertake it and form a committee to do that or not? And I think that's something that that this group could consider next meeting. Having decided to do that, if next meeting you decide to do that, then we can form the people, you know, give them the marching orders, and they can brief out structures, recommend structures, take friendly amendments, do whatever we need until we get it right and pass, and then set up. We kind of need permission to go further. We don't see an easy way. This all started looking at that kind of that little health services piece, and they're not connected. They're functioning, but not well connected. And it's a lot larger issue than that, we feel, having looked at it. So we're going to propose essentially starting at, you know, going back to about the 30% area and rebuilding it.
We're actually identifying the areas where all four constituencies have
correct
vested interest. Campus community issues.
Well, when you look at the committee structure, there aren't many committees that aren't campus-wide and four constituencies. They actually, I can't think of one that's very narrowly defined as a faculty issue or a student issue alone. The planning committee, I mean, it's transportation, they're all campus-wide.
When we looked at it, when did the representation from the key constituencies, we didn't have a structure to deal with that. It is, what committees should we have, and subcommittees, and you know, how tall is the tree versus how wide, and the reporting structures and mechanisms like that when they do their business. And so having four, or you know, representation from the four groups, and then what level of representation, that's probably the part that is least broken, perhaps not broken. The structure of the committees themselves and who reports to whom and how they're connected seems to be either needs more clarity or needs to be rewritten, we feel. This small group. I mean, the larger body may disagree, but I know we're running late, and in fact, you know, why don't we present more clearly at next meeting, and if we can get the time on the agenda and see what the broader group wants to do.
I'd like to be a part of it. If you're going to have another meeting, I'll come. You just have to work it out.
Actually, would the next step then be that resolution as we discussed in the meeting, Ari?
What resolution?
We discussed about creating the official ad hoc resolution.
Okay. Well, maybe what we can do is get together and draft and talk about what form it might take.
And this would probably run over into the beginning of next
academic year, since we only have basically two meetings in April left.
Just from my experience, but I'm envisioning this will be a lot like the EAA's charter review process.
Took a year.
I would say that was probably a less extensive review than this would be, and that took the better part of this year.
So just to clarify, next meeting we're doing board safety and then this issue, correct? Is there anything else at work?
Do you think you'll have the rest of the CJC stuff for that meeting?
If you think we can fit it in time, I could have all the information ready to go. There were, I believe, 12 smaller code changes, of which 9 were finished as of last night.
Okay.
If you would like me to prepare something, I could. It's more of a matter of time if we can fit all that in within an hour and a half.
This is 2 weeks from today.
Yes.
And what we could do is ask if we could make it officially till 6:30.
How about?
I'm asking the body to see if that, because if we add CJC on
faculty senate meeting that night. Okay.
2 weeks.
Kate is trying something.
Yeah. How about I send you a resolution by Friday of everything and all the other things we've covered, and then you can either add
it. Well, how many does it affect? How many does it affect? Me and Elizabeth, I guess.
Yeah.
I would guess then, also we would probably like to get this room scheduled, which I think I'm going to contact
you. I'll have to take a choice, Elizabeth. Maybe send that. What about the 6:30? Because this is a lot of stuff.
I think we need to finish our legislative agenda, and I so move that we, if needed, we extend to 6:30 at the next meeting.
Second.
Okay.
All want to vote?
No, can't we do something like consensus?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Anything else?
So you're not following the chart.
I'll have Amy book this room for our next meeting.
Hey, it'd be great if we had a report about the
sometime soon.
Okay.
So there's 9 of
them. If you think it's not funny, you can.
No, it's not.
Because we'll be meeting next week.
Are we officially adjourned? Are we officially adjourned?
Can I have a motion to adjourn, please?
I make a motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous.
I have a suggestion. Why do you have a suggestion? You have a guest room. Put them over there. By the door, so people can see them best.
Okay. I didn't set them there.
Yeah, no, we're still. That's okay. I'm just saying that if I come in, I'll tell them or whoever.
I think Amy's in there.
Yeah, I think it's better to put.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.